Let's talk then about what we're going to do tonight. It's probably the easiest exercise tonight, as you would expect for the first. If you did print out what you were supposed to bring, go ahead and take that out. But we're not going to go through this. Actually, this is an unusual week. Normally, the exercises I was just talking about, the things that you do here, you show me that you've done before you leave to get credit for them. This is an exception. This actually is homework. So you should bring this back completed next time. It's also unusual in that, really, even though this is Bio 182, tonight's material is from Bio 181. So this is all stuff that you should have learned. Everyone has taken Bio 181, right? I think you have to. You haven't taken it? Okay, do you know Mendelian genetics? I like that positivity. Well, it's a review of Mendelian genetics, which is not only important to 181, it's just important to biology. When I'm talking about Mendelian genetics, first of all, it's in honor of Mendel, right? That's why we call it Mendelian. Who was Mendel? Not everyone at once. Well, maybe we have to be here tonight longer than I thought, if no one has ever heard of Mendel. Yes, he was definitely involved with pea plants. What was his first name? Gregor. Gregor Mendel was a monk who lived a while ago in what is now, I think, Bosnia. But anyway, he was a monk who figured out a hell of a lot about genetics without any knowledge of what a gene is or even what DNA is, for that matter. This is well before all that information came. So it was amazing, the work that he did, but none of it was appreciated at all until 30 years after he died, when it was finally found by someone who said, this might be something. So now we refer to him as the father of genetics. But when we're talking about Mendelian genetics, we're talking about genes that operate in a Mendelian fashion, and not all genes do. So the mode of inheritance that we call Mendelian genetics only applies to certain genes. But first of all, what is a gene? Keeping in mind that this is all stuff you're assumed to know already from 181. What is a gene? Now, are you afraid to give an answer, or is it true that no one knows what a gene is? It corresponds to a trait. Actually, I'm glad you said that, because it doesn't correspond to a trait. It corresponds to a characteristic. But a gene is an actual thing. It's an object. More about this difference between characteristic and trait in a minute. But a gene is not just a concept. A gene is a thing. What is it? No idea? Seriously? Well, what is genetics all about? What is it? DNA. That's what genes are. They're made out of DNA, right? Every chromosome has one long DNA molecule in it. Well, as a percentage, only a tiny fraction of that, so about 1 to 2% of that DNA material, is actually used as genes. But genes are simply sequences of nucleotides, which are the building blocks that make up DNA molecules, right? DNA is nucleic acid, specifically deoxyribonucleic acid, right? Nucleic acids are polymers that are made up of monomers or subunits called nucleotides. And so one long DNA molecule is a huge sequence of nucleotides. Within that overall long sequence, there are shorter sequences that we call genes. That's what a gene is, sequence of nucleotides. But functionally, what is a gene? Meaning, what is it there for? What is the job of a gene? What does that DNA do, in other words? Do you want me to just keep giving the answers? A gene's DNA stands as a code for how to build something. What is directly built using the code that's in the DNA of a gene? Not directly. Proteins, in most cases, ultimately. But DNA's code is there so that the cell knows how to make another nucleic acid called messenger RNA, right? Ribonucleic acid. And what is that process called? Making the mRNA using the code that's in the DNA. Transcription, exactly. Now, in most genes, that's not the end product. The messenger RNA now serves as a code for the next process called what? Translation, which uses the code that's in the messenger RNA to make a protein. All right? In humans, there are roughly 20,000 such genes. We call them protein-coding genes because the ultimate end product, well, I guess that's redundant, the end product is protein. There are some genes that are not protein-coding, and what are those genes for? Well, what are the protein-coding genes make directly? I just told you this. Did everyone hear that? If you're going to answer, you're going to have to speak as loudly as I am. What do protein-coding genes directly make?
mRNA.
Yes, mRNA, which is a type of RNA. Not the only kind of RNA. So what are the non-protein coding genes coding for? What do they make? They make the other kinds of RNA. Transfer RNA, tRNA, for instance. There's all kinds of RNA. Small nuclear RNA. Ribosomal RNA. All of these different kinds of RNAs don't just pop into existence. The cell needs to know how to build them. That's what the other genes are for. But in Mendelian genetics, what we concern ourselves with are protein-coding genes. And now to this difference between characteristic and trait. Not all geneticists make this distinction. I think it's a good distinction, though, so I'm going to make it. There's a trait and characteristic, colloquially, out on the street, are used interchangeably when we're not talking about biology. But in genetics, there's a difference. A characteristic is something that's observable about an organism, right? For instance, eye color. That's a characteristic. A trait, on the other hand, is any one of the possibilities for that characteristic. So, there's not just one eye color, right? Green-eyed versus blue-eyed versus hazel-eyed, those are all different traits of the same characteristic. All right? What is it that gives an organism its actual traits? Well, trait and phenotype are pretty much interchangeable. But what I'm saying is that is what is it? What is the stuff that actually makes you look the way you are, makes you smell the way you are, makes you taste the way you are, gives you all your traits, your ability to think the way you do? And what are alleles, though? But that's an indirect answer, though. That's actually not the correct answer, what I'm looking for. Most people would say, especially if you were asked someone on the street, not a biologist, they would say your DNA gives you your traits. DNA is involved, but DNA only indirectly gives you your traits. You appear the way you do, you're able to do the things you're able to do directly because of the proteins that you're able to make. It's proteins that directly give you your traits. And there's no limit to the number of proteins that could be made by assembling the 20 different biological amino acids in different ways, right? That's what proteins are. But what is it that allows a cell to know how to build a protein? It's the gene. So your DNA defines from birth the whole set of proteins that you're ever going to be able to make. But it's the proteins that actually give you your traits. All right? Now, since you said allele, I want to make the distinction between, I want to define that. What is an allele? Do you know? You use the word. You do get two different genes of the same kind, one from each parent. And that's what alleles are. Alleles are different versions of the same gene. Now, there are different kinds of genes as well, right? For instance, if there is a gene for eye color, there's another gene for hair color, just to use it as an example. Well, eye color and hair color are what things that we've just talked about? They are characteristics. So genes correspond to characteristics, but alleles correspond to traits, because for your eye color gene, the actual color of eyes that you have depends on which allele of the eye color gene you have. There's multiple alleles possible for any given gene, in other words. Okay? Everyone clear on all that? Then let's talk about before I get to that, one more thing about Mendelian genetics. Like I said, not all genes behave in a Mendelian fashion. For a gene to behave in a Mendelian fashion, there are two important assumptions or requirements that must be met. One is that there are exactly two alleles for the gene you're interested in. There's only two possible alleles. Not one, not three or more, two exactly. All right, that's one assumption. The other is that one of those two alleles is completely dominant over the other, which doesn't always happen. So either one of these two requirements can be violated. You can have more than two alleles, in which case the statistics come out differently compared to Mendelian genetics. Or you could have one allele that's not completely dominant over the other, for instance, in incomplete dominance. But speaking of dominance, what am I talking about? We have dominance, and what's the other word? Recessivity. Right. A dominant allele is called a dominant allele because in an organism that has one dominant allele for that gene and from the other parent, a recessive allele for that gene, the single dominant allele is all that is required for that organism to exhibit entirely, fully, the dominant phenotype or the dominant trait. Okay? If you have two dominant alleles, of course you're going to have the dominant trait. But in Mendelian genetics, if you have only one, that's enough to give you fully the dominant trait. Okay, so phenotype we've already described. That's basically the observable trait of an organism. What is a corresponding word other than phenotype? What is it? Genotype, right. Well, what does genotype refer to? What's the difference between the two? Very similar words, but except for those first couple letters. The genotype refers to the actual DNA that the organism has. In other words, the version of the allele, the version of the gene, the specific allele that an organism has. And when I say the, it's because usually we restrict ourselves, our attention, to just one gene at a time. We don't care what's happening for all the other characteristics. If it's eye color, that's all we're interested in, so we're just looking at one gene. And if it's a Mendelian gene, then there's only two alleles possible. Right? Okay, well, genotype is going to be denoted by symbols. Symbols that indicate which actual alleles are held by that organism. We are examples of diploid organisms, right? We're diploid animals. And what does diploid mean? Anyone? Diploid is one version of ploidy. Diploid means having two of each kind of chromosome. I mean, each kind of, chromosome. And therefore, two of each kind of gene, because genes are on chromosomes. Why is it that a diploid organism has two of every gene? Why? Because we're sexual organisms, right? Not all organisms reproduce sexually. We do, and therefore we have two parents, not just one. We get a chromosome of each kind, and therefore a gene of each kind from each of our two parents. So that leads to three possibilities, basically. We can receive, in any case, we're receiving two alleles for a given gene. One possibility is that those two alleles, one from the father, one from the mother, are the same type, right? Another possibility is that one of them is different from the other. So that's two overall possibilities, and what words describe those? What's the situation of having two alleles of the same type for a given gene within an organism? Yeah, homozygous. Homo meaning same. And if you have one kind from one parent and a different allele from the other parent, it's what? Heterozygous, yes. Now, I said that there's actually three possibilities, and that's because there's two possible ways you can be homozygous, right? Your two same alleles can both be the recessive version, in which case you would append this word with the other word recessive. So it's not enough to just say homozygous. You can be homozygous recessive, or you can be homozygous dominant, if both parents give you the dominant allele. If you're heterozygous, that word alone is enough, because it already tells you it's one of each. And you don't care which parent gave you the dominant and which gave you the recessive. Okay, so you split this into dominant and recessive. Okay, those are the three possibilities. So when we study Mendelian genetics and try to predict, basically, what offspring will look like given a mating event between two parents, we summarize that with what shorthand device that we draw? A Punnett square. Yeah, let me see whether one of these has better ink. Because I assume you guys can't see that at all back there. Yeah, a Punnett square, which is named after Punnett, who first used it. A Punnett square, which in it, a Punnett square in general, let's say a four-celled Punnett square. Like I said, it's just a shorthand device, but it represents some real process. What process, what biological process does a Punnett square represent? I can't hear you. It is, reproduction is involved. But reproduction is actually a whole bunch of processes. What gets the ball rolling in reproduction? What specific process? We have to have a sex talk? During sexual reproduction, what two things are combined? Sperm and egg, and what are sperm and egg examples of? What kind of cells? Sex cells, otherwise known as what? gametes, exactly. And so the Punnett square represents the thing that has to happen for there to actually be eventually offspring formed. And that is the union or the fusion of the two gametes, right? What is that fusion of two gametes called? Fertilization. That's exactly what a Punnett square represents. Fertilization occurring when two specific individuals that you know the genotypes of mate. Well, they don't necessarily mate. Not all sexual organisms mate. But when their gametes come together, however that occurs. All right? So, back to genotypes now. If you have a certain gene that you're interested in, which corresponds to a certain characteristic, the phenotypes, the traits, are expressed as phrases, right? Like green-eyed. That's the phenotype. Genotype, like I said, is a sequence of symbols. So the cross, which is the two parents that are going to undergo fertilization, can be represented as one genotype crossed with another genotype. Okay? And like I said, we're ignoring all the other genes these organisms have. We only care about one at a time. Now, there's unfortunately multiple standards in genetics that we use for these genotypes, but the one you learn first is that you use an initial that describes the dominant phenotype, right? There's a dominant phenotype if we're talking about Mendelian genetics. So, if we say, if we're looking at the A gene, whatever A stands for, we use A for both the dominant and the recessive allele, right? How do we tell the difference between dominant and recessive alleles? By case, exactly. So A, uppercase A would be dominant, lowercase A would be recessive. So if we have a heterozygous individual, one of the parents, that individual genotypically would be symbolized as upper lower A. Why are there two A's? Why does this one individual, the one parent, and it doesn't matter whether it's father or mother, why are there two A's just for that one person or one organism? In other words, it's a diploid animal. Diploid organism, doesn't have to be an animal. Okay? So the adults are diploid. Therefore, their genotypes must be diploid. Two A's means that they have two A alleles. One from its parent and the other from its other parent. That's going to be crossed with another individual that's diploid, so that you need another diploid genotype. Let's say it is a homozygous recessive individual for the other parent. That describes all you need to know genetically about this cross with respect to the one gene that you care about at the moment. Okay? On a Punnett square, there are things that go above and to the left of the square, and there are things that go in the boxes. What go above and to the left of the Punnett square? Well, they're genotypes, but they're genotypes that represent what actual biological entities? Not the parents, no. When, during sex, two parents don't meld into one individual, right? What is it that actually combines? The sperm and the egg, which we said are what? Gametes. Fertilization is the union of two unicellular haploid gametes to produce one unicellular diploid zygote, right? That's what fertilization is. So What is the process that biological process that produces gametes called? Meiosis. Meiosis randomly chooses one of the two alleles that that person has or that individual has and puts it into either an egg or a sperm, right? Into the gamete. So meiosis can randomly choose either of two alleles here, and therefore this parent can make two different kinds. Let's say this is the female. She can make two different kinds of eggs. An egg that chooses this A and an egg that chooses this A. That's what you put on the left. It's an exhaustive list, a complete list of every possible gamete that this individual can make when all you care about is that one gene. You do the same thing for the other parent. In this case, it's the same one, so you really wouldn't even have to have a four square Punnett square. You could have just one column and two rows. But you might as well write it all out. So these are not individual parents. These are the gametes that came from these parents. And the reason Punnett squares work is because you're doing conceptually exactly what fertilization accomplishes. Choosing one gamete and matching it up with one gamete from the other parent to produce what? What is produced in the act of fertilization? A zygote. And that's exactly what the boxes inside represent. Zygotes. So it's just matching up row with column. And notice that the two columns are identical, which is why we could have just written this as one column and two rows. Now, so this is a complete list, an exhaustive list of every type of zygote that these two particular parents are able to make for this one gene. All right, there's no other possibilities. But importantly, the Punnett square does not say these parents are going to produce four zygotes, right? They can produce one, a million, it depends on the species. This just says these are the four possibilities. And because it's random, every one of these possibilities is just as likely as any of the other possibilities. In terms of the heterozygous and homozygous words that we used, notice that two of these individuals are heterozygous, the top row. The bottom two zygotes are both homozygous recessive. That's the only possibility. Because of complete dominance, which we're assuming because it's a Mendelian gene, it only takes one of the dominant alleles to make that zygote completely dominant in phenotype. So these two, phenotypically, will be dominant individuals. These two will be recessive individuals. But for different Punnett squares, remember that there's two different ways that you can be dominant in phenotype. There are two different genotypes that correspond to the dominant phenotype. You can be homozygous dominant, or you can be heterozygous. There's no homozygous dominant in here, but that can happen, of course, right? So what this says statistically, since these are all equal possibilities, is that however many offspring these two individuals produce, exactly one half of them, or two-fourths, if you made it one column, it'd be one half. Here it's two-fourths, which is one half. One half of them will be dominant, the other half will be recessive. Okay, so if they make 500 offspring, you'd expect 250 of them to be dominant, 250 to be recessive. Not exactly, because it's random, but that's what you would expect. And that's what Punnett squares are. They're predictions about what actually will happen when two individuals reproduce. All right, any questions on anything I've said since I started the science part of this? Well, do you think you're well armed for answering the questions then? Okay, I hope so, because based on the responses, it might just be that you're shy tonight, I don't know. But based on the questions that I threw out at you, it seems like you need a little brushing up. Anyway, that's what we're doing tonight. Well, I mean, that's, I'm really done for tonight. And like I said, this is unusual in that you're not really doing it here if you don't want to. You're welcome to stick around and ask questions and to speak with each other. And as a matter of fact, since we're going to be working in groups on the normal weeks coming up, you probably should group yourselves the way you want and introduce yourselves and exchange contact information. And you can stick around and talk about these problems or try some, or you can take the chance and go home and do them there. All right? Remember those three who haven't signed the rules consent form, do that.